WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Republican convention last week was very much the Donald Trump show, co-starring the shouted stylings of Kimberly Guilfoyle. Trump talked law and order and the Democrats' post office scam. That's how he put it, and how things were pretty much perfect before, quote, the plague came in from China. 4 years after accepting his first nomination, the president's relationship to the Republican Party still confuses many people, both inside and outside the party. Is Trump an aberration within the GOP? Is he different from the party's culture and policy assumptions? Or does his presidency represent a continuity from the Reagan era onward? To answer that very complicated question, our staff writer Andrew Morantz sat down with historian and journalist Rick Perlstein. Perlstein has just published a new book called Reaganland. It's the capstone of his four-volume history of the American right. Here's Andrew Morantz.
So Rick Perlstein is this journalist and historian who he's been writing these really kind of monumentally big and immersive histories of essentially the 20th century American conservative movement. So just to set it up, you know, for those who don't know, for the last 23 years, you've been working on this four-book cycle, some 3,000 pages, right? How many pages?
That sounds about right, give or take. You know, it's like Everett Dirksen, you know, the late Illinois senator used to say a billion here, a billion there, and soon you're starting to talk about real money. You know, yeah, I mean, let's say 3,000 pages. Sure.
Yeah. I've always been interested in his books because, you know, there's a lot of presidential biographies out there. There's a lot of, you know, books about American politics out there, but his books are kind of unique in how much they're about the mood of the country, the popular culture, what it was like day by day, week by week to live through something like Watergate or to live through something like the late 70s where, you know, New York City is having a blackout and nobody knows, you know, where to go and everything is kind of chaotic. And that kind of feeling and that mood, you can kind of get from Perlstein's books in a way you can't really get anywhere else. Where Rick Perlstein starts his four-book cycle is with the 1964 race. And this was in an era when the two parties were not ideologically sorted the way they are now. There were liberal Republicans, there were conservative Republicans, there were liberal Democrats, there were conservative Democrats. It was a coalition of regional interests, but it wasn't, you know, it had ideological blocks. And it was actually seen as self-defeating to be too ideological.
So the narrative was that the American right was this kind of wild west of open racists, anti-Semites, you know, conspiracy theorists, was, you know, had no kind of purchase in American politics. But the idea is that, you know, William F. Buckley comes along.
We will explore the question of the future of the GOP and of the conservative movement. I take pleasure in introducing a great man and a good friend.
He's this, you know, bright young Yaley, speaks fluent Latin, you know, and he starts a magazine, National Review, you know, the marquee conservative magazine that started in 1955, in which he's going to turn conservatism into basically an intellectually respectable movement.
The only successful mutiny against the political scriptwriters in recent times, it having been ordained that no forthright conservative could be elected to any important executive office.
And that not in the largest... through that act, that's what allows someone like Barry Goldwater to come to the fore as a nominee for the Republican Party without that taint of open racism, anti-Semitism, and all the rest.
So Barry Goldwater was this very staunch conservative senator from Arizona, and he stood for this ideologically principled conservatism, which was often called extreme. And actually, Goldwater famously embraced that label.
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
And when he got the Republican nomination, it was this surprising, shocking thing, kind of not entirely unlike when Donald Trump won the Republican nomination. But then what was supposed to happen next with Trump did happen with Goldwater, right? He lost in a landslide. So this thing that we were predicting would happen in 2016, that did happen in 1964. So then all these sort of nice, clean-cut liberal historians got to say what they wanted to say all along, which was Goldwater was always too fringe for the American electorate. He was never electable in the first place. This just shows that if you're too extreme and you're too ideological, you're never going to get anywhere in American politics, right? And so that became the entrenched narrative.
I really accepted sort of a standard narrative of the history of conservatism propounded by conservatives themselves that central to their political success, basically how they entered prime time, was through the act of disciplining the fringes of their coalition.
So Perlstein's second book is called Nixonland, comes out in 2008. And that's about the rise of Nixon, how he triumphs in these two big elections. Then in Perlstein's third book called The Invisible Bridge, we start getting Nixon's downfall. And by the middle of that book, Nixon is disgraced. He's left the White House. It just seems like no one of his ilk is going to be able to rise again. Nixon was this kind of shocking, alienating, angry figure. And so how can that right wing of the Republican Party ever be successful again? So you're kind of, you know, spit out into this landscape of, okay, Nixon's gone. The country needs a unifier. And everyone at the time is kind of assuming that that unifier is going to come from somewhere from the center of the political spectrum. And what Reaganland shows is that Ronald Reagan was able to become that unifier, not from the center, but by actually picking up on the really ideological, extreme conservative commitments of Richard Nixon and just kind of putting a more optimistic, shiny gloss on them.
I believe the Republican Party has a platform that is a banner of bold, unmistakable colors with no pale pastel shades.
One of the things that made Reagan's election so paradigm shifting was that he managed to attract an enormous amount of former Democratic voters into the Republican coalition. But by the same token, in this long campaign in 1980, he received some rather remarkable endorsements. And perhaps the most remarkable was Martin Luther King's right-hand man, best friend, Ralph Abernathy, in whose arms Martin Luther King had died, who gave a very warm and enthusiastic endorsement of Ronald Reagan. Now, in a lot of ways, that shows the extraordinary charm and political gifts of Ronald Reagan, but it also shows a absolutely bedrock part of the Reagan strategy, which was that they knew that if they appeared, if what we now call, sort of white swing voters in the suburbs, associated Ronald Reagan with bigotry and racism, that they wouldn't vote for him.
But then as Pearlstein is putting the final touches on this magnum opus, he's writing the fourth installment of how modern conservatism came to be what it is. As he's doing that in 2015 and 2016, he's watching Trump spit on John McCain's legacy as a war hero.
I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you. Do you agree with that? He's a war hero.
And, talk about how all the Republican trade policies of the last 20 years should be thrown out the window and, saying the quiet part loud. And
they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
All this carefully calibrated dog whistle strategy that all these Pearlstein books show how carefully plotted the dog whistle politics of racism has been in the Republican Party, and how hard they've tried to build a Southern coalition based on, appealing to racist tendencies but not saying that stuff out loud. As he's sitting down to write this book, Trump is winning a Republican primary by saying that stuff out loud.
This is a country where we speak English, not Spanish.
Can you think of a time when you were writing Reaganland and then, you finished a day's writing and sort of like flipped on the TV and saw Trump talking about deporting 12 million people or saw him talking about, executing the Central Park Five or something and went, I might need to revise what I wrote today? Or, did you ever have those moments?
It's still happening, right? Right now we're talking as, the QAnon cult, that Democrats are, involved in a conspiracy to kill children, right? Is entering the mainstream as never before. And I woke up this week, this week in which I'm promoting the book and, thought, well, a huge part of the anti-gay agenda that drove the Christian right during the period I'm writing, that really kind of replaced segregationism as the kind of guiding rage among fundamentalist Christians, was the conspiracy theory that gays were recruiting children. And in the case of a very prominent minister named James Robeson, who's still around and still prominent, in the spring of 1979, he gave a broadcast in which he said that gays in widespread organized fashion were not only recruiting young boys, but murdering them. His affiliate, the place where he recorded his show, it took him off the air because this was kind of like a last straw. He, attacked other religions so much. And in this particular case, the local gay group demanded equal time. And this was a galvanizing event. He became a martyr. It became one of the galvanizing events for the politicization of the Christian right going into the 1980 election. And him and his young publicist, the fellow named Mike Huckabee, staged a rally in which 10,000 Christians hooted and hollered and basically were advocating for him to have the right to go around saying that gays were out to murder children. And Mike Huckabee was actually interviewed in The New Yorker. And he was quoted saying that there was so much feral rage in that building that if James Robeson had told people to walk down to the TV station and take it apart brick by brick, they would have done it.
I'm sick and tired of hearing about all of the radicals and the perverts and the liberals and the leftists and the communists coming out of the closets. It's time for God's people to come out of the closets, out of the churches, and change America.
Right, so that kind of energy is certainly not new with Trump. It probably has not had that much explicit representation in a place like, say, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, for whom, certainly in the case of Ronald Reagan, disciplining what got said behind closed doors and in public was an enormous part of the political work of that administration.
Rick Perlstein is a guy who writes from a left vantage point. He writes for leftist publications. He writes these books that are about the modern conservative movement, but yet he's not writing these books as polemics about why conservatism is bad. He's writing a version of conservatism that actually some conservatives recognize themselves in. Like, he's more interested in giving a really rich chronicle of almost the psychological needs of the American populace. Like, what was it in the American psyche, or almost in the American soul, that made them yearn for someone like Ronald Reagan? This seems to be one of the underlying narrative questions of this book. Why was someone like Jimmy Carter not enough? Why did America fall out of love with him?
It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will.
And I think where other people might look to some specific political outcome, or they might look to the hostage crisis, or they might point to this or that speech, I think Perlstein's move is much more often to set a mood and talk about why the mood of the country was out of step with the mood that was being conveyed by a particular campaign or by a particular White House. 1977 was the era of Star Wars and Rocky, and that was what people were clamoring for. They wanted these very clear-cut stories about good versus evil. They wanted the heroes to triumph in the end. And Star Wars was not a Jimmy Carter type of film. Star Wars was a Ronald Reagan type of film. You know, so that's really more the kind of analysis you get in these books. Obviously, you get a lot of politics and you get a lot of, you know, who did or didn't vote for this or that bill. But in the words of another conservative figure of this century, Andrew Breitbart, he had this phrase, politics is downstream of culture. And I think that's the sense you get from reading these books, that culture and politics are certainly all mixed up together. And there's this kind of intangible mood of any given moment that I think Perlstein would probably say is only fully knowable in retrospect, that he's trying to unearth, that I think sometimes can explain as much or more than, you know, a political science analysis can.
There is this, you know, constant appeal for, you know, reactionary ways of seeing the world, that the world is a scary place, America is a scary place, and people want to revert to, you know, easy truths and binary black and white ways of seeing the world. And that's just a constant in American history.
Rick Perlstein is the author of 4 volumes on the conservative movement. Reaganland was published this month, and he spoke with Andrew Marantz, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick. It's The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code radiohour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Rachel Syme is a staff writer who covers fashion in its many forms for The New Yorker. She's written for us about the trend toward high-rise jeans, a history of the tracksuit, and now she's going to show off the must-have fashion item of 2020, and I do mean must-have, the face mask. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
You getting out of the house much?
I wish I was more, but I'm taking a lot of walks. I took a bike ride to Central Park this weekend.
Did you wear a mask?
I did wear a mask.
Good, because that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about masks and mask fashion, because in a time like this, we could use a little diversion, I think.
I think so. Let's divert.
So, what is the mask of choice that I should be looking at, or we should all be looking at?
Well, listen, I'm no doctor, so I can't tell, but I think, you know, mask wardrobes are becoming a whole thing. You know, people have like a daytime mask and an evening mask. I mean, there's everything from the basic medical sort of paper masks all the way up to masks that cost hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars. For example, Burberry recently announced that they will release a mask in their trademark plaid with the red and the brown stripes, you know, like if you're going out fox hunting, that kind of a vibe.
Ah, fox hunting.
Yeah, that's, I think, $130. Off-White, which is Virgil Abloh's label, made a mask that just says Off-White, like they always do. They branded everything.
So the era of conspicuous consumption persists even during the plague.
I mean...
Too weird.
Unfortunately, too weird. Yes.
What is the selfie mask?
The selfie mask is a very creepy thing that you can get where you basically send in a selfie to a company, and there's several companies that are doing this now, and they will print a mask with like the bottom half of your face so that it really looks like you, but it also kind of looks like a clownish, uncanny valley version of you, like you're wearing a permanent clown smile of yourself.
Is that a good look?
I mean, I think it's actually nightmarish. I feel like it's something from like a David Lynch movie. I don't know that
exactly.
I would. I feel like they're terrifying, but people want to look like themselves more than ever. I think people feel that a mask that blocks half their face, I mean, no one can see you smile. No one can see what your, you know, your facial expression really is. So I think people are trying to figure out ways to be more transparent, which leads us to this transparent mask called the Leaf, which is this, the best way I can describe it is it's a clear version of when you're in an airplane and the oxygen mask drops down. It's kind of like a little bit of a, it kind of looks like that very close suction to the face type thing. It's plastic and transparent, and then kind of also though has like a not transparent part about the chin, so it looks a little bit like you're wearing like old school like orthodontic headgear.
That's a memory that everybody will want to come back to.
Yeah. But at the same time, part of me just encourages people while we're in this mask phase of 2020 to embrace all these new options.
All right. Well, what I want to know is, what is the most expensive mask in the world?
Well, apparently a $1.5 million diamond and gold mask is coming out. Only for the purpose of being the most expensive mask in the world, just so they can say they did it.
That's just such good news.
I mean, you're, you know, it's maybe it's an investment piece.
Rachel, thanks so much.
No problem.
Definitely putting down a deposit for the $1.5 million mask with its diamonds and gold and N99 filters.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you in it.
Rachel Syme is a staff writer, and you can read her work, always a delight, at newyorker.com. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us, and please don't miss us next week when I'll be talking with Bette Midler, the one and only, about her new show. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.